Welcome to the Full Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:12 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is March 12th, and of course, today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. First, let's have a review of what's been happening this week. And the picture in stock markets has been for a very firm week, with an increasing number of markets breaking upwards to new recovery highs, and no globally significant market breaking to new reaction lows. So that's all really quite positive action. The last couple of days have also been characterized by relative strength in this in the banking sector in the USA, being led by the regional banks. And the regional banks are important because these are deposit-taking institutions that are more or less wholly committed to what one would describe as normal banking activities, rather than sponsoring hedge funds or private equity or flotations and that type of investment banking activity. The regional banks are more representative of what's actually happening on the ground in the various states, and the fact that they're leading to the upside is really quite positive. So we have the KBW Regional Banks Index leading to the upside. The S&P 500 banks also broke to new recovery highs this week, so that's also really good positive action. Elsewhere in Asia, the Malaysian market has been one of the first to break to the upside. There are a number of testing those February highs. In some cases, January highs. And we continue to see that the majority of markets have found support in the region of their 200-day moving averages and are rallying now to test their recovery highs, or have pushed on to new ones. Some of the weaker markets, such as even Greece or Spain or Portugal, have also firmed really quite considerably and now appear to have put in a new low. So even those markets, which until really only a couple of weeks ago were being categorized in a pariah fashion, really have rebounded here. So we have entered a really quite bullish period for the majority of stock markets. In the commodity markets, this week was characterized by really quite extraordinary volatility in some of the precious metals. On today was the fourth consecutive day where an earlier move was countermanded completely in the second half of trading. So there were 2 days this week where silver, for example, pushed to the downside but closed to the upside, and there were 2 days where it opened early in the morning and pushed up to new up into positive territory, only to close on the lower side of the day and closed down around the $17 level this week. It continues, even though we do have this very volatile activity from one day to the next, it continues to look like a normal size correction within the current uptrend, and really would need to break through to the downside from this current range to really question scope for this to be anything other than a little reaction within the overall bullish environment. And gold continues to consolidate around the $1,100 level. Again, this is one that had been up there at almost $1,120 earlier on today, but lost the whole gain and finished on the downside. In the platinum market, the operative level is in the region of $1,600, and for palladium, it's in the region of 450, where we're seeing that these precious metals are gravitating around these round numbers, and they're in need of some further bullish activity to push them on to the upside. The industrial metals have not been as volatile, but they are also consolidating for much of the week and have held the majority of their gains that they've put in, particularly over the last 4 weeks. This was a week in which the euro firmed somewhat against the dollar and broke out of this little range in here today, so pushed up to 137.63 into the close. It really does need to do more to indicate that it has broken the dollar's 3 to 4 month uptrend. It's very difficult though to be bullish of the dollar, and while there is an intense concentration on the euro dollar exchange rate, there is a much wider world out there, and the dollar strength isn't nearly as evident in a large number of other currencies, particularly those that are in Asian emerging markets or commodity producing countries, Australia, Canada, and a number of Latin American countries. So the and indeed the rand. So we do have this environment where the major markets are the major currency markets where everyone is really concentrating are. And this big argument about whether the dollar is a strong currency or not really is sidelined by the really quite strong action that we're seeing right across the emerging markets and commodity-related markets. The Asian dollar index is pushing on, it's pressuring its recovery high today, and it came within only a few points, a few ticks, in fact, of pushing to new high ground. So when you look at a whole basket of Asian currencies that are on the verge of breaking on to new recovery highs, it's very difficult to then turn around and say that this is a strong dollar story. What we've had, particularly since January, is a weak euro story. And the euro today got a little bit of relief. But we saw that the dollar has weakened against a range of other currencies, such as the Australian dollar, and the Canadian dollar hit a new high against the Austra against the US dollar in here today. A new recovery high, I should say. So I think the main point with the currency markets is that this is a always a two-way game, and it never really pays, I believe, to look at to take absolute views with regard to the currencies. And it is really a game of matching the strongest with the weakest. And I think categorically one can state that currencies such as the pound, the euro, and the dollar are all in the weak category when we compare them to the Asian and commodity producing currencies. Government bonds are also interesting in here because we're seeing that yields are picking up for some of those stronger commodity producing countries. You have Australia, Canada, New Zealand, all rounding around looking like they are preparing to break to the upside in terms of yield. That would suggest that there's going to be further pressure on some of these governments to raise interest rates. Now, Australia has been leading the way. It's already raised interest rates by a full percent in about 6 months. Canada is constrained to a certain extent because so much of its trade is with its southern neighbor. And the Canadian currency getting down there to parity isn't going to be particularly welcomed by Canada's exporters. So they're rather constrained here, but the bond market does suggest that investors are demanding more yield for some of these currencies and countries in anticipation of inflationary pressures appearing somewhere down the line. So there is very much a two-speed world out there where we have some of the better performing countries already tightening monetary conditions. That's actually a misrepresentation. What we have is a number of currencies, of countries, sorry, removing stimulus, and we are nowhere near yet to a major tightening. When you look at the yield curve charts, and we have a large number of those in the chart library where we've spread the 10-year over the 2-year. There is a very much two camps that the world can be divided into. There are those where that yield curve continues to steepen, and those countries are the UK, the USA, Europe, And you have those where monetary conditions, while not tight just now, but certainly we're having stimulus removed, and the countries that fall into that category are China, India, Australia, and Canada probably belongs more in the second camp than the first camp. So this is a change that we that is really quite evident. We're seeing it in the performance of stock markets, the performance of the currency markets, the performance of the bond markets, and it does suggest that investors are splitting the world into two halves, and those halves are far from equal in terms of investment potential. We have, on the one hand, the countries that are fueling the growth of the global middle class, where the greatest urbanization in history is currently taking place, and the countries that are their clients, delivering the commodities that are needed to fuel the development of those economies, both in terms of building out the economy, developing the infrastructure, building the houses, and providing that new middle class with the standard of living that we take for granted in large parts of the world. And they're getting on there with business as usual. And in the countries that have been most affected by the credit crisis, where there is growing government debt, where deflationary pressures remain evident, where there is a lot of slack in the wider economy, the companies that are benefiting most are those that are leveraged to growth in the global economy. So, for example, we see that markets that have already broken to new recovery highs, Switzerland is one of those, with Nestlé leading the way. In Finland, it is Nokia, which is obviously selling phones into those markets. We have Denmark, where you have a comparatively large weighting of shipping companies, which are leveraged to the global economy. So you have the Nasdaq, which is obviously the big technology market, and technology is a cyclical full of money theme because technology in terms of information technology is a cyclical full of money theme as well, because it is because you have flagship companies there that have developed their own niche market and dominated and lead the world in their sectors, and have the stock market performance both in terms of absolute return and leadership to back it up. But all of these country indices or sectors that are breaking up to new recovery highs right now are either recovery candidates or are leveraged to the global economy. And that is further evidence that the main investment theme that we have out there is the growth of the global middle class, and how are we going to supply the billions of new people with cash to spend on improving their lifestyles with exactly what they want, because they'll want nicer places to live. That's certainly the infrastructure side of things, but they'll also want to make those lives more comfortable, and that is where the consumer goods factor is heavily dominant. So that is the big picture long-term outlook, and we continue to see that emerging markets have been leading the world both in terms of performance and in the timing of their advances. They have continually led to the upside. And that doesn't appear to be about to change. Now, we will always have the Wall Street leash effect, because obviously Wall Street is the biggest capital market in the world, and the money that flows both in and out of the USA particularly, and Europe as well, will have a large knock-on effect in the emerging markets. that is something that's going to be with us for a considerable period of time. So we will always need to keep an eye on what Wall Street is doing. But what Wall Street is doing right now is very sanguine. We have the S&P on the verge of pushing on to new recovery highs. It probably did it today, but closed back below the 1150 level. Well, 1149.99, in fact. So what we have is a cyclical bull market for a number of these stock markets, and that is supported by the secular bull market in emerging markets and commodities that are largely interdependent. When we look at these precious metals in particular, gold has sustained this move above the $1,000 level really quite admirably, and it's back above 1100 in here over the last couple of weeks. It found support in the region of its 200-day moving average. It's rallied back above that area. It's consolidating in the region of this $1100 level, but there is it doesn't yet show the kind of characteristics that say that this thing is really getting ready to run to the upside, but neither does it suggest that we're going to go back down and test the $1,000 level. So it is in need of probably a catalyst, and probably ones to watch will be the other precious metals, particularly palladium, because it has tended to lead in the current cycle and was pushing on to new medium-term highs over the last couple of weeks. I'd also like to talk briefly about the shale gas story, because that is something that has the potential to change the energy sector in no uncertain terms. And we've had commentary on it, both for and against, almost every day this week. There was something I wrote on December 7th, and I've dug it up. And this was the comparison between Louisiana shale and shale gas and what was coming out of Alberta. And for a $400,000 well, you would get 150,000 cubic feet in. For every $400,000 well, you'd get 150,000 cubic feet per day of gas. Whereas in the shale, it costed 10 million to build to dig the well, but you were getting 8 million cubic feet per day. So it meant that you had to dig an awful lot more wells in Alberta to get the same amount of gas. Now, there are problems with shale gas peaking out early because you have this remarkably high initial pressure that it's incapable of maintaining, but you're getting such remarkably high volume that this really is a game changer. Now, there are environmental problems, there are problems with getting some of this gas to the market, and there is also, of course, the problem with we now have the supply, but there's also the demand element. So this is something that does have the potential to change the energy markets over the medium to longer term. At the moment, it's probably putting downward pressure on natural gas prices, and natural gas prices were lower again in here today. So they've pushed that now down below $4.50. They're at 4.38 as I speak. And this has been a considerable deterioration in prices over the last couple of months in particular. Natural gas is now becoming quite cheap relative to oil. And I think we can probably draw the conclusion that anybody who could change from oil to natural gas has probably already done so. And with the way that this excess supply is putting pressure on the natural gas prices, it makes the case more compelling for switching, where possible, from oil to natural gas as a feedstock for power plants or for transport. There, it's probably going to be difficult to sell having a high pressure tank of gas in the back of a car to soccer moms, for example. But it is probably something that we will see more of in the future, because natural gas, there does really appear to be plenty of it around, and it is in relatively politically secure parts of the world. We need to be responsible about how it's going to be taken out of the ground, and certainly to protect the water table if that is indeed a serious threat. But this does have the potential to change the energy complex really quite remarkably. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening and wish all the best to all of you.